Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Hello, hello, hello. Philip Boucher-Hayes in with you for a week or two, and I am very happy we are starting with a good news story, and this one in particular, because it's somebody that I happen by coincidence to have talked to sitting in for Joe back in March. Nikita Healy, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon.
I think if people are going to try and remember you from March, they're going to have a bit of a hard time, because I think you're probably a completely different person today to back then.
Yeah, like I can't even think back to how different I was back then. A whole different person.
Yeah. When you and I were talking back then, you told me that the pain was at an 8 or 9 out of 10, that you were doubled over in the bed and you hadn't gotten out of it basically in about 3 months.
Yeah.
It must have seemed like a pretty dark place at that time.
Yeah, I didn't realise how low in mood I was and how depressed I was until a few weeks ago.
When you got your surgery. So look,
yeah.
Let's just go through this step by step, because endometriosis was what you had diagnosed yourself with, but even in spite of the severity of your condition, you didn't have a diagnosis back in March, did you?
No.
So what happened after that?
We ended up speaking to Mary Lou MacDonald and Senator Marie McCormack, who gave us a few doctors who were abroad, and me and my mum did our own research, and we found that Dr. Mitroi in Romania, he was the best option. So we got in touch with Dr. Mitroi, and in May, I believe, we went over for our first visit, and I got an MRI done, and within an hour I was told I have endometriosis and adenomyosis, and the endometriosis is now compressing the nerve, and if I don't get surgery within a year, I'll be in a wheelchair forever.
So in this visit in May, within the space of one day and one visit, you had a diagnosis at Dr. Mitroy's clinic that the Irish system hadn't been able to give you.
Yeah, and I had two MRIs done privately in Ireland, and we brought them with us, and they had a look at them MRIs as well, and they said we can see it's after growth.
Okay. Your body had been telling you all along, though, that this was endometriosis. Everything that you had read said, yeah, that describes what I'm going through, But the system here wasn't able to agree with you.
Yeah, I was let down a lot by the HSE, and then to go over to a whole other country and have them tell me if I didn't come here, I'd be in a wheelchair forever. It was the best decision that me and my family ever made, but it's not a place that I should have happened to go to.
No, and it's not a decision that's without consequences or financial consequences anyway. But look, let's just talk about the procedure for a second. So you trundled in there in a wheelchair, and did you literally come springing out of there a couple of days later?
Yeah, I went in on a Thursday for surgery, and by Saturday morning I was up walking by myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
And describe the physical sensations. What did you feel was going on in your body after the surgery?
The second I woke up from the surgery in intensive care, the only way I can describe it is I felt lighter. Like, I felt like I wasn't holding this dreaded pain anymore. My mum couldn't come down and see me, so they gave me the phone, and my mum said, "It's mum," and I said, "I have no pain anymore," because I couldn't feel, like, even the normal pain that women with endometriosis have, like, that wasn't there anymore, and I hadn't not felt that pain in so long.
Okay. Tears of relief, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And were you sure then that it wasn't just the drugs not having worn off, you could actually tell, I don't have pain anymore?
I could tell straight away. I don't have any pain.
And so what difference has that made now?
I've started college. I'm resitting my leaving cert in college, and I'll be sitting it in June, and then hopefully I'll be off to college doing nothing.
So you have
and
a college place.
Before.
Okay, because, sorry, of course, back in March when you and I were talking, there was no question of you being able to study through the pain barrier and sit your leaving cert, was there?
No, I couldn't do it at all.
How had the mocks gone, remind us?
I tried to sit. I set one exam, and within 15, 20 minutes, I had to leave. I couldn't focus.
Oh, God. And now, tell me, you know, what are you doing? What are you able to do that you weren't able to do sitting in that room by yourself?
I'm able to go out with friends. I'm able to look at the future and be like, oh, well, yeah, I can go and get a driver's license. I can go to college. I can go get a job because there's nothing stopping me now.
Because it struck me, and this is the thing that I kept on thinking about after our chat, was that you were in the loneliest place because you couldn't sleep at night. You were, you know, darkest hour before the dawn, sitting there by yourself. And even when daytime came, there weren't going to be that many friends knocking on the door every single day because you couldn't expect them to just come and sit in a bedroom with you.
Yeah, because they were out living the life that they should be living, that I should have been living, but I couldn't.
But you're out there now, mucking in.
Yeah.
Have you lost those friends insofar as they're now a year ahead of you and they've gone on to college, or have you a new group of a circle of friends around you?
No, I'm still friends with them, but since speaking about endometriosis, I've met so many women who have been in the same situation, who are still in the same situation, who they're just like me now, what I was like back in March, and they have nowhere to turn, nowhere to go, and they don't know what to do. Then there's women who are 10 years post-operation and they're still no pain, living life the way a normal person should.
We talked in March about the possibility of this surgery offering you some relief, but I kind of got the instinct that you didn't believe it, that you were in such a sad and a lonely place that it was hard for you to think about a life without that pain. Would that be fair?
Yeah, definitely. I kept being told that I would feel different after it, but when you've been in pain for so long, you can't really imagine what life is like without it.
No, I cannot completely understand that. But yet, here you are. The people who offered you that hope, they've come good on it.
Yeah.
That must be, again, just, you know, a complete 180 degrees change of direction for your life.
March seems like years ago compared to how I am now.
Yeah, I know. Okay, 51551 is the text number. Stay there because your mum is on the other line. Angela, did you give her permission to bunk off school and take this call with us, or have we created a problem in the Healy household?
I think you created something.
please don't be too angry with her because it is important. Well, the reason that we wanted to talk to you and to her today is because of the National Endometriosis Framework being launched there at the weekend. We'll come to that for a second, but let's just go back to that phone call from post-operative recovery that Nikita made to you and saying that she was pain-free. Did you believe it could possibly be true?
I kind of wanted to believe it, but in the back of your mind, you're kind of saying, well, how is it not being recognised right now? Like, it was 4 years. Nikita was in the system for 4 years over here in Ireland. And when you go to a different country and get told within a half an hour this and this is what's wrong with your child. And we did have a few tears because them doctors were believing what we were saying.
Was it as simple as that, Angela? Literally, one consultation, one procedure, and she's cured.
A half an hour with coming out of the MRI scan. Within that half an hour in the hospital, we had the results within, I'd say, 10 minutes after coming out, when Nikita came out of the MRI scan. We had the results. Like 10 minutes. Crazy.
It is mad. And because this is the thing that I'm having a real problem getting my head around, in spite of the amount of evidence and the amount of MRIs and different visits, she didn't have a diagnosis when we, not an official one anyway, when we were talking back in March.
Yeah, no, she had no diagnosis at all. So to hear that has your child not been questioned, why is she in a wheelchair? Has your child, like, if your child stays like this, if she doesn't get the surgery done in August, if she's left like this next year, she'd be like that for the rest of her life.
Could have been irreversible.
Because the compression was very bad. And we're still waiting now for physio. She needs to get physio done, because all her left side is very weak.
It must be, at the same time though, Angela, the most immense relief. I mean, frustration I can understand, but there she is, back in school, studying, career plans, driving licence in her sights.
I can't keep her in nowadays, these days. She's out with her friends. She's like, it's amazing to see. And she keeps saying to me, "Mam, will you stop looking?" Because I keep smiling every time we're out walking. I'm like, I'm so happy. Like, I just can't believe you're walking around beside me.
"Mam, will you stop looking at me?"
Yeah, she's like, because I just keep smiling. I'm like, so, like, you know, that stupid smile.
I know, the big goofy, proudest punch smile.
She's after starting our fourth step for the fourth time again. But the thing was, when we went in after the surgery and we went for our weekly visit before we went home, I'll never forget what my dad said. "I will owe you everything," he says. "You've made my granddaughter a new lease of life, and I'll never, ever be able to repay you for that."
Yeah. And whatever the cost, I'm sure it seems like small change by comparison with, you know, her condition, her state now. But what was the cost that you've absorbed?
For the surgery or for the whole trip?
For the whole trip.
At least 15,000.
Okay. And that wasn't easy to come by, I would imagine.
No, definitely not.
And what are the chances of getting that back?
Cross border only pays for surgery, which was 11 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, I won't get back.
Flights, hotels, incidental costs in Bucharest and all of that.
There's hidden costs as well, like Nikita would have having to be injected every day for blood clots. She had to get tests done, blood tests, urine samples, a heart murmur, all them cost, where you're not told that there, you're only told that the surgery is 10,000.
Okay.
But then it's hidden costs with an extra 1,000 euro on top of it.
Now the
and then if you're there longer, it could be
more.
You know, painkillers, antibiotics, all of them, that it just costs, you can run up into the thousands.
Now, the National Endometriosis Framework that the Minister launched on Saturday, what do you see in that would have made a difference to Nikita's circumstances had it been in place 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Well, the only thing now that I can think of is that they're actually letting you, they're coming up with the money up front.
For surgery.
You don't have to go and try. Yeah, you don't have to go and get a loan.
Okay.
They're going to give it to you up front.
But let's just take it in its stages. Like, do you think that it would improve the chances of diagnosis and a quicker diagnosis if Nikita was to be presenting with her condition now?
Yeah, it could be done quicker, but I just think, like, there is a few specialists that want to come over here and train people in into what was done. But that's not happening. Where they're putting the money into the cross-border and pumping money into that, where it should be pumping the money into the specialists.
Yeah, because tell me about this. The clinic that you went to, how many people was that specialist seeing every day?
From Ireland?
Well, no. Just how many people was he performing the procedure on?
I think
I've seen a figure somewhere anyway that there was about four or five procedures a day. That, like, it's, sorry, I don't mean to sound crude about it, but there's a kind of a conveyor belt of people going through there, and you know, nothing comparable in this country.
Three a week in Ireland, from Ireland. At least three people from Ireland. I know that.
But you would like to see his opposite number doing the same number of procedures here in this country, presumably.
Yeah, well, the surgery Nikita got could take up to... It won't go back for 8 to 10 years. Surgery that gets done here only lasts us 2 years.
Okay.
So I just don't understand why they don't bring these specialist people in that's willing to train them for free.
Mm-hmm. Nikita, how do you feel about that now? Are you so thrilled, skinny and chuffed with yourself that the possibility of the condition recurring is just not something that you're even thinking about? Or are you kind of relieved that if it does, at least you can go back for surgery again?
I am relieved in a way, but I think it would be very, very hard for me to trust our healthcare system again. Like, I can see myself having to go back, if I ever do have to get surgery again, going back to Dr. Mitroi in Romania. I can't see myself trusting Irish doctors again.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how this new framework beds down, and hopefully you'll be proven incorrect on that. But, you know, as we say, let's just wait and see. Will you stay on the line, both of you? I'm joined by somebody else now, 51551, Robin Murray. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Lovely to talk to you. Thanks for highlighting this again today. It's great to hear endometriosis spoken about on the radio again. So that's a positive.
Well, it is a positive because we're talking about a condition that there's anywhere between 150 and 300,000 women suffering with. 300,000 people with varying stages or severities of this condition is really something that's quite hard to get your head around. And what's your situation, Robin?
Yeah, so I'm one of the 300,000 that we know of that have endometriosis. And I have stage 4. But again, you could be stage 1, stage 2, and still suffer just as badly. The staging is just like how far it spreads to different organs. It doesn't refer to any of the pain. So you could be stage 4 and have no pain, or be stage 1 and be completely debilitated. But I was actually there on Saturday and I did welcome...
At the launch, you know, of the framework, you mean?
I was there, and I was there at the forum as well. That was kind of fed into that as well last month. So there was a certain amount of patients invited to a forum with the minister last month where feedback was taken from various different women with different backgrounds who have endometriosis in Ireland. And I was glad to see that a lot of the points that we had raised were listened to. And one of them being that the financial barriers that women struggle with in Ireland to go abroad. So I very much welcomed the new framework and the new scheme. Of course, you know, it's a pilot scheme. There's going to be holes in it. But I think it's a massive step in the right direction for women in Ireland.
Is there a problem that you would have to have a diagnosis in the Irish system, which, as you know, Nikita's experience has shown, is quite slow, before you would be able to get that money?
Yeah, that is, I have to say, that's a barrier that, I mean, we need to have that changed. But again, like, it's a pilot scheme. So, like, I would urge people, and I've wrote in myself, once I was able to read through the framework myself, obviously I got the booklet and I was there listening, but I didn't fully take everything in. But I read the booklet and there is holes in it. But it's up to us to go back then and say, no, sorry, this is not good enough. We need to be able to be looking at women who don't have a diagnosis, because we want to be able to have people go abroad to be diagnosed, because obviously there is easier ways to be diagnosed when you're abroad.
So money up front, please, to assist with that journey to get the diagnosis, and then money up front for the procedure if that is what is required. But hanging around in Ireland waiting for a diagnosis is not going to be a solution.
Absolutely not. No, I was 10 years myself.
Oh, Lord. Really?
Yeah.
And what is there in the framework that, if it had been in place 10 years ago when you were first developing your symptoms, would have made a difference now, Robin?
To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what would have made a difference. As I said, like, I welcome the framework, but it's very much a stepping stone. It does still have holes in it. So even if I had been there 10 years ago, I'm not sure, because we don't have, you know, the specialists in Ireland, that I still would have been able to be helped. We still need to bring specialists into Ireland to be able to train the doctors that we have here. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, that's not happening. So we can have a framework. And while I welcome the framework, we need to do a lot more work with bringing in, you know, initiatives to bring in doctors like Dr. Dimitri and doctors from the US who will be able to train our specialists and upskill our own. That, to me, would be more important than what's in the framework.
Because with 300,000 people, I mean, and 30,000 severe cases, it certainly sounds like if we had a specialist in this country, they would not be underemployed, would they?
Absolutely not. I mean, a friend of mine is actually travelling to Greece in 2 weeks, and she's having a massive surgery. It's 8.5 hours, and she will be having half her diaphragm resected. Lisa Walsh is her name, and she runs her voice project with me. And she's heading abroad to have this massive surgery because, unfortunately, it's just not available here.
Okay.
And she'll have to stay in Greece. She can't book a return flight home.
0818 715 815. Hannah Coyle is on the line now as well. Hannah, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. So tell me, what was your reaction to the endometriosis framework?
So I suppose, like Robin said, like, I do very much welcome the framework, and I do think it's brilliant that we have something now to reference, but I do think there's still so much work to be done with it. Like, from my perspective, I was very disappointed with it for a few reasons. Like, I suppose, you know, the way they kind of say it, you know, paracetamol is an effective pain relief, is just, like, completely untrue. And I feel like any woman with endometriosis will attest to that. And, I mean, it kind of...
Explain that to me now, Hannah, because, you know, what Robin, what others have been saying there is that everybody's in levels of pain can be different. So are you saying that nobody responds to paracetamol?
Well, I mean, I'm sure some people would, but just speaking from my own perspective, it would be useless, really. You know, endometriosis is one of the most painful conditions in the world. So saying that paracetamol is an effective pain relief is a pretty big statement.
And is the Irish system not able to provide you with more powerful painkillers on prescription that you can take home and medicate yourself with?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, depending on your doctor or whoever you go to, or if you go to a pain specialist. But my point is that it says in the framework specifically about paracetamol.
All right. And you think it felt dismissive to you, did it?
Yeah, in a way. And then, like, that along with, like, it kind of hints towards that a multidisciplinary approach would only really be necessary in, like, deeply infiltrating endometriosis cases or really severe cases, which I also think is a bit dismissive of someone who may have, you know, stage 1 or stage 2, but have you know, further involvement that requires a multidisciplinary approach, but in the framework it's kind of saying, oh no, it's only people with really severe endometriosis that would get the MDT. And then I suppose the main thing from my end, like, I haven't gone abroad for surgery, but it's definitely something that I've considered and want to consider for the future, because I'm still not better off from having surgery here. But like, so they released that they are going to pay up front, but only to specific centres. And the two that I know Nikita was talking about, Dr. Mitroy in Bucharest, and then also Dr. Dinos in Greece, aren't on the list of approved centres we can go to if we get paid for in advance.
So hang on a second. Are you telling me that the two centres that the majority of Irish women with this condition are travelling to at the moment are not on the list of approved providers to get the bill paid?
Yes.
Have you any idea why that would be the case?
No. I've been racking my head all weekend since it came out trying to figure, and I just don't. I can't understand what a reason would be for that. Like, it's very, and I know it's been brought up in, like, when there was the Sinn Féin motions at all, when there was a patient symposium with Minister of Health, like, it's those two clinics specifically, especially for me, like, what I've heard from other people, those two clinics are the ones that come up time and time again. So I'm like, how did that not translate across to be in the approved list?
Okay. So there's quite a few snags here there. There's no money up front for a diagnosis. You still have to wait for a diagnosis in this country, and that is slow. There's two of the centres doing so much of these procedures on Irish women, not on the approved list, and so on. You say that, you know, the language that's being used sounds or feels to you dismissive. What in this is good, Hannah?
Like, I think obviously any endometriosis, like, campaigner, or, you know, people that are trying to raise awareness are, this is great because we're finally getting like a public kind of idea of what's going to happen. But so, like, in that sense, it is really good, and it's so welcomed to have this framework and to have things being put in motion for, you know, conditions here to change. And like, obviously the, like, them saying that they'll pay before you go if it's on the approved list is really good if people are happy to go to those places. But I do just think there is work that needs to be done on it. And I know Robin said the same, that it's the stepping stone. Like, there's still so much more to be done.
More work to be done, indeed. Nikita, are you still there?
Yeah.
I have on the other line somebody that you met in Bucharest. Wendy Feely, good afternoon. How are you?
Oh, good afternoon, fellas. And hello, Nikita.
Hi, Wendy.
How are you, Nikita? It's so good to hear you. And you sound absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Were you having the same procedure done at the same time, Wendy?
Yes, Philip, I was. I met the lovely Nikita and her lovely mammy and the rest of her family over in Bucharest. And yes, I had a similar procedure to Nikita. And Philip, it was just so amazing to see this lovely young girl at the ripe old age of 18 going through what I was going through as well. But to see her the day before surgery sitting in a wheelchair, and then the day after surgery to see her walking, it really felt like a miracle. And I can only just imagine how her lovely mum Angela felt. I was going through the same thing, but, like, you know, I was a lot older than Nikita. I'm in my mid-40s.
Well, how long have you been living with it, Wendy?
Well, on reflection, Philip, I'd probably been living with it over 20 years.
Oh, God.
And I didn't know it. And I actually only got my diagnosis in June. And
when had you
I
first gone looking for answers, Wendy? How long before you got that diagnosis?
In my late teens was the first time I was hospitalised. And I actually only knew and was told it was endometriosis the 20th of June this year.
So how long is that?
That's a grand. So that is well over 25 years, Philip.
Oh, God. And Wendy, yeah. that feeling of lightness when the pain is gone that Nikita describes, did you get that?
When I opened my eyes after surgery, it was like I literally opened my eyes and all the pain was gone, completely and utterly gone, that I had been living with for over 25 years. And it was an unbelievable feeling. And it's now 10 weeks ago since I opened my eyes, and I can honestly say it was the best decision I ever made to go to a specialist in Romania.
What is that like, though, Wendy? I mean, when you have had pain as your constant unwelcome companion all that time, do you even recognise yourself living without it?
No, it's a completely different life. And I keep pinching myself. And, you know, obviously, you know, you have to recover from surgery, but I still knew inherently that it was gone. Like, the pain was gone. I can't even begin to feel or to describe how good it is not to live with daily pain and heaviness in my body.
But it must be with a sense of frustration, though, when you think back on those 25 years.
Well, it is. And I think, you know, when I know now what it's like, see, I didn't actually know, Philip, and I had been to all the doctors and MRIs and scans and everything here, and nothing was ever detected. And I was actually lucky in an unlucky in one way, but I actually ended up having an almost 7 centimetre endometrioma tumour. And that's the reason why I was flagged as extremely urgent here in Ireland, because it was actually affecting the way that I could walk. And I actually had bought a walking stick. Thankfully, I didn't have to use it. But I knew then that I needed surgery. And then I decided to start my research. And every single time I was speaking to or got in touch with somebody who had been through the process, they all recommended, please make sure you go to a specialist endometriosis surgeon.
And was your body telling you that it was endometriosis all this time, Wendy?
Well, I knew there was something not right, but I definitely knew there was something not right, but I honestly didn't know. I didn't know what it was. And, you know, when I had all the scans and they came back clear here in Ireland, you do start to question yourself and think, is this the way everybody feels in their body?
I know.
Do you know what I mean? So you kind of thought, you know, but I knew it couldn't be right, because my energy levels, and I could see other people and wonder, my goodness, how can they have so much energy
thank
and
God
no pain? And,
it's
you know,
in your past, Wendy. This is it.
I know.
There's
I know.
Nothing
I know.
But sunlit upland in front of you, I hope.
Sorry, Philip, sorry.
I said nothing but sunlit uplands in front of you, I hope, Wendy.
Absolutely. Sunshine and rainbows from there on. But you know what? I have to say, I am so happy to hear Nikita and her lovely mammy, because, you know, to see such a young girl at 18 and to have found the appropriate health care and the outcome
before having to live an adult life with all of this. And you know what? There are many, many people, Nikita, I hope you will be pleased to hear this, in the Nikita Healy fan club, and thanking you for your advocacy on endometriosis. We might get to some of them later on, but right now I have to take a break. Nikita, the best, and thank you so much for taking the call. And if your mum gives you hell, thank you for making the call. And if your mum gives you hell about skipping school today, blame us, all right? Bye.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Mandy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
So you're in Paris right now.
Yes, I am.
Would you tell me, please, where were you yesterday between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9:45 a.m., please?
I swear I was not robbing the Louvre. I was in bed and I woke up to the news that there was a heist, and I couldn't believe it. It was the most crazy story I think that's happened ever in Paris.
So you were in bed. Is there anybody else that can provide you with an alibi and swear to that?
No, you're just going to have to believe me. It was a Sunday morning.
It is an absolutely crazy story. And we are in no way heroising the people who committed this crime. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there's some drama to it, isn't there?
Yeah, I feel like it's the type of thing that happens in a Batman movie. It's unbelievable that that's something that actually happened in real life.
Yeah, that a group of people dressed as workers during a time when the museum is being renovated, though I'd imagine the Louvre for some part of it is always being renovated, it's so large, use a service elevator, use cutting implements to get in and to get into the display cases and then make off with all of these priceless, priceless items. And you were, by coincidence, actually due to go to the Louvre today.
Yeah, so I work sometimes with a tourism company because I'm a content creator on social media. And I often film videos in Paris for different content clients. And today I was supposed to go and create some photographs and videos for my client. But the Louvre is closed today. It's closed. It was closed all day yesterday. Today it's closed as well. And tomorrow they're keeping it closed as well.
I'd say there might be a little bit of a review of security arrangements ongoing, which again, under the circumstances, is completely understandable. Is anybody in Paris talking about anything else other than this?
To be honest, it's kind of the biggest story at the moment because everybody is so much just in complete disbelief about it. The jewels that were stolen had survived the French Revolution. So for them to disappear in a heist like this right now is just so unbelievable. I think everybody is just stunned at what happened.
Now, not, I will have to admit, that I had any huge affection for the crown of Princess Eugenie before now, or could even have told you what it looked like. But it is quite sad, isn't it, to think that the only possible use for anything like that is to be broken down and for the constituent stones to be taken away and recut so that they look completely different, for them to have any value to anybody.
That's the thing, because it's not just an expensive piece of jewellery or an expensive item that's been stolen. It is a historical artefact, and that's the thing that can't be replaced. So, yeah, it is kind of tragic for that to happen. But at the same time, it's just, I have so many doubts now about the security in French museums, because for that to happen in broad daylight, it's such, I don't know, I'm just dumbfounded. I can't believe how easy it was for the robbers to do.
Yeah, easy. You make me think that you might be thinking about taking a look back at some of the content that you've created in these videos and saying, is there another weakness in the Louvre for me to exploit? Or maybe I'll move my focus to the Musée d'Orsay.
Look, all I'm saying is the robbers have some taste, because that jewellery was gorgeous. Like, I would wear it, you know. But yeah, no, they did the whole thing in under 7 minutes. So they make it look easy, the way that they stole it.
Cliona Doherty, where were you between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9:45 yesterday?
I was prepping my boyfriend for his county final, so I definitely wasn't in Paris.
And he will back you up on this, will he?
Yes, he will, yeah.
You had a show of work in the Carousel du Louvre?
Yeah, so my artwork was featured in the Carousel du Louvre, which is an international exhibition space located just beneath the historical museum in the Louvre.
And what was that of, Cliona?
So it featured one of my paintings called Laura, which was from my Intimacy collection, and I was represented by an Austrian gallery called PAX during Art Basel Week. So it was the contemporary art shopping fair that was put on by the Louvre during Art Basel Week. So yeah, it was very exciting.
Describe the Intimacy collection to me.
So it featured 30 women across Ireland. It kind of came out during COVID. I realised when I was searching online for the female form to be able to paint, the images coming up weren't exactly like, nice. So I reached out. I had a small following at the time on Instagram, and I reached out asking if any women would be interested in sending me their images of, like, their most intimate moments and for me to paint them. And I got over 30 images from different women across Ireland, and I was able to build a collection then of paintings.
And doing what in those moments?
Like, it ranged from different women and different ages. Like, some of them were mothers that just was taking their 5 minute shower and was just maybe standing, like, reveling in the silence, and the others were maybe making their breakfast in the morning completely naked because they lived at home and they were able to just be so free in their body. It was all little small moments like that.
The most natural thing in the world to walk around your house with no clothes on whatsoever. Not by the Irish moral standards, though. The most natural thing in the world to allow that to be committed to. Is it oil and canvas or acrylics, or what are you working in?
Acrylics and canvas.
Okay. Are we still squeamish about nudes and nude art in this country, do you think, Lena?
Yes, most definitely, yeah. It's still quite a taboo subject. Now it is kind of getting slightly better, but it is still quite taboo. I do meet quite a bit of resistance when it comes to galleries, and most of my collectors are outside of Ireland. So I do see the pushback sometimes, like Irish people kind of want the Cliffs of Moher and sheep.
It's funny, isn't it, in 2025 that we haven't really moved on beyond, as you say, the Cliffs of Moher and sheep. So are you knowingly, self-consciously actually limiting the possible buyers for your works by painting nudes? Or in this country, anyway.
Yes, probably. I just definitely say it's very niche. But then, like, if you look back throughout history, the female form has always been painted. It's just in Ireland, it has always kind of been repressed. And I'm okay with that. Even if I have one buyer in Ireland at a time, I'm able to, like, talk to them about it and, like, show them that nudity, especially the female form, isn't something that is sexualized. So even if there's just one person, I know I've made a little bit of difference.
No, it's not sexualized. It's the most, as I said, normal thing in the world to wander around your house nude. But I'll bet that the majority of Irish people would think twice before hanging a nude inside their house, because they know that anybody coming in would think, oh, hi, hi, oh, well, we know where your tastes run, don't we?
Yeah, yes, it is still very sexualized, and especially, like, when I meet people and I explain what I do, I get a lot of comments and, like, rude comments that you can't really say on air and things like that. And you do meet that kind of friction and that kind of, like, mindset of it being heavily sexualized, when reality more than half the population has the same parts of their body that I'm painting.
Well, and the whole population has nude bodies underneath all of those clothes, don't they? Now, anyway, exactly, we've gotten massively, massively off the point here. Your nudes were hanging in the Carousel du Louvre. Were you ever worried about their security? Did it ever even cross your mind that somebody might clep it and make off with it?
Honestly, no, because the Louvre is known for having one of the most, like, intense security, like, regiments for museums. So, like, it didn't even cross my mind that, like, a robbery could happen or, like, something could go wrong. Like, when I was standing at the opening night, there was 10,000 people there, and I it never even crossed my mind.
But would it now?
You just kind of, I think it would. You kind of put your blind faith in the fact that they're so well known for their security. And, like,
At the same time, though, Cliona, you know, if the Louvre comes calling again, say, we'd like to hang some of your pictures, you're not really going to say no, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm just kind of going to light a candle and hope it doesn't get robbed.
And Mandy, back to you. What's the buzz like now in Paris?
The overall buzz, I think it's just people are really dumbstruck and dumbfounded
by this entire situation. Because it really is just so surreal.
There's a particularly beautiful picture doing the rounds taken by a press photographer of three gendarmes lounging on the bonnet of a squad car outside the Louvre, presumably near the entrance where the robbery was committed. And there is the most dapper looking gentleman you have ever seen in your life, with a beautifully pointed trilby and the most immaculately pressed waistcoat and a walking stick in his right hand. And you're just wondering to yourself, why are the gendarmes not looking at this fella now and asking him a few questions? Because if ever there was a man who dresses like an art thief, it was this fella. So I would have to imagine that the whole of Paris is looking around and saying, oh, could it be him? Could it be you? Does Mandy's alibi of being at home alone in bed by herself add up?
Well, see, the thing is, you see all kinds of things in Paris on a daily basis, but after a while, everything just kind of blends into the background, because it's very normal just to see very dapper, well-dressed people, the odd crazy person walking around. And even with the mechanical ladder that they put up, it just looked like normal maintenance or construction, because the buildings in Paris are so old that a lot of the time things are under construction and nobody pays any heed to it whatsoever. Why it's the same
you?
As...
Why would you?
Yeah, Absolutely. Exactly. So I think everything just kind of blended all together and nobody saw anything that looked particularly out of the ordinary.
All right, Mandy, good luck getting your story straight before the gendarmes arrive, because you've failed to convince me of your alibi. But thank you very much for taking our call. Bye.
Look, maybe I should come clean now.
You know what? I think it might be easier in the long run.
We'll see. We'll see.
We'll take
but
a break.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Gerry Doran, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Philip. How are you? Good.
I am excellent. Does it make any difference to you that McVitie's aren't really able to use the word chocolate with the gay abandon that they once were?
Yeah, I've seen this come up a little bit now on the internet and on websites, etc. I think it's to do with the percentage of cocoa solids that is in the chocolate now. That under EU legislation, which I've been aware of, in order for a bar or a biscuit to be considered a milk chocolate, it has to have a minimum of 25% cocoa solids. And I think this bar in particular has less than 25%. So technically and under EU legislation, they can't call it chocolate.
No, 24.9% or 24.8% or whatever, they can't use the word chocolate. They could say chocolate flavoured, I think, can't they?
Chocolate flavoured is what they can call it. And it's become the same, apparently, with lots of the other chocolates around, not just bars, like not just, McVitie's bars, but some of the others, you know, the milk chocolate that we used to buy, that we buy in the shops. A lot of those are, you know, between 20 and 23% cocoa solids. So I've been aware, actually, that Ireland and the UK have got an opt-out clause that they can say it's 20%. But we're actually... there's a lot of additives in there, like palm oil and stuff, which is having a little bit of an effect on the taste. And if you look at some of the bars now in the shops, you'll see that they no longer say chocolate on them. They just have maybe the brand name. So they can't say, they could say, for example, you know, just Cadbury's call it dairy milk. It doesn't say Cadbury's dairy milk on the bar. It just says... it doesn't say chocolate on the bar, it says dairy milk.
Okay, well, all of these confectioners have been trying to play a cunning game, reformulating their products very slowly and very gradually so that they bring their customers with them on this, I don't know, they probably call it a taste journey
exactly,
or something like
that's
that.
That's exactly what's been happening.
But have and you noticed a difference, Gerry?
Well, yeah, I've been a guy, I like a bit of partially a bit of chocolate, sweet stuff, that kind of stuff. So I do like a nice chocolate bar. So I've been aware of this, and I've been looking at the content of the cocoa solids, and also the sizes as well have been coming down. the sizes of the bars have been reduced.
Well, shrinkflation is a different thing, isn't it, really? Because the reformulation thing, even with the dark chocolate products, I've noticed, you know, having not gone anywhere near one of those particular brands for years and years and years, and then had it relatively recently, that they're compensating for the reduced amount of cocoa in it by lumping a whole lot of extra sugar in there. So you're still getting
a taste sensation. And things like palm oil.
Yeah.
Other things that, palm oil is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not, conducive if it's a lot of it in the products.
Well, it's not necessarily a good thing either for the parts of the world that are being deforested.
I know. But the problem is, too, the issue that they would say, some of these manufacturers, is the price of cocoa has gone through the roof over the past number of years. But the other side of the coin, which is an interesting, is the own brand products, like we say, the Aldi or the Lidl products, they can their own brand chocolate contains an awful lot more cocoa solids than the standard generic brands like Cadbury's and Nestle. And I don't work for them, but I've observed this. There's a higher content of cocoa in these brands.
Are you a study the ingredients on the back of the packet in the supermarket aisle before you purchase?
I'm trying to. I've just become more aware as a consumer of some of the things that's happening.
More people would join me, because I do that, and people look at me like I've got two heads, and they say, "Would you get out of the way and stop blocking access to this particular aisle?" But on every shop, I say that there's going to be one product. Because you can't change your entire shopping basket. No, but I always say there's going to be one product that I'm going to get a better version of than the one I have at the moment. But not if I leave my glasses at home, because the print is so small. So has this changed your chocolate or chocolate-flavoured bar eating habits? Are you spending a little bit money and buying less frequently, or have you just forced your palate to adjust to this mocklet?
Well, all things in moderation, as they say, and I would be partially with the chocolate, so I've had to cut back for health reasons. Not that I'm a vast consumer of chocolate, but I've cut down a little bit, weekend treats, etc. But I have been aware of the cocoa content in the chocolate, and also aware of the palm oil in some of the brands. So I've moved personally myself to the store brand chocolates, because I feel that they're a little bit better. The quality
That's
is
interesting.
A little
okay,
better.
Top tip. I hadn't noticed that before. But I mean, one of the other things that you would have to have noticed, you couldn't have failed to have noticed, is how the advertising slogans and the marketing has had to change around these products.
Exactly.
Like the Club Biscuit original slogan was, as you will remember, "If you like a lot of chocolate on your biscuit, join our club." But now they have to go with, "If you like a lot of biscuit in your break, join our club."
Very, very subtle. But they just have to. The average person, including myself, would possibly not notice the taste. But they just feel that, it's a little bit disingenuous of not. They're not maybe bringing down the prices, or maybe to compensate for the shrink inflation as well. But I was amazed to find out that Ireland and the UK have opted out of the cocoa solids. We got a derogation as well, which is interesting. So Cadbury's or the other brands apparently would probably have a higher quality of chocolate on the continent than what we have in Ireland and UK. And I always thought that Irish and UK chocolate was some of the best.
It's changed. It's changed. If you woke somebody up from a 20-year coma and you fed them chocolate today, I have no doubt that they would say, "What's this? That's not chocolate."
I know.
All right, Jerry. Good man yourself. Thanks for the call. Take care. Keep it between the ditches.
Okay. Thanks very much, Philip. Take care. Thank you.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
Dearin, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me on and for speaking about the platform or the framework.
The framework, the endometriosis framework. Did you hear Nikita at the top of the programme, Dearin?
I did. Nikita is a fantastic young woman. She's doing us all proud in the community for speaking out.
And does her story give you heart?
So it gives me a lot of heart for the younger generation, for sure. And I'm so glad that Nikita got sorted, and I don't mean sorted loosely, that she got seen too early in her life and that she's able to move forward with the diagnosis and with treatment and with monitoring. And she knows now her future pathway.
And is that procedure an option for you, Dearn?
So I've had 15 surgeries. I'm diagnosed 20 years. I'm just back from Romania because I'm too complex for the Irish hospitals. So I've a lot to process. I got my results on Thursday, and it's spread to areas that are difficult to process. It's in the brain. It's potentially moved into my right diaphragm. I have cysts on the liver now. I have a lot of work that needs to be done. I've got veins wrapped around the base of my spine. So the surgery needs to be done with a specialist.
Several specialists, I'd imagine. And how many?
Several.
How many procedures are you talking about, Dearn?
I have no idea yet. I went to Romania with an idea of how bad things were. But I came away with extra issues, and I'm still only trying to process it. I'm back a week since Friday. I got my results on Thursday, and I attended the framework on Saturday morning.
And are each and every single one of those areas that they have identified operable, or are there some that are just too complex?
I've been told out there that the severity of the pelvic congestion now is, it could render me in a wheelchair if I had the surgery done by a surgeon that wasn't trained. They need to decompress both sides of my pelvis, and I've basically been told to choose the worst side for now because doing both at the same time is too high risk.
Sorry, what does that mean, decompress your pelvis?
There's pelvic congestion syndrome, so it's like varicose veins in your pelvis, and they're, because they've been left go undiagnosed for so long, they're in a bad way, so they have to go in and they have to decompress the nerves and the veins.
Okay, and the chance of getting the use of that leg back is what?
They haven't even discussed that yet, so we're not even at that level of discussion.
Okay. So at the moment, it's just pick a leg that you don't mind not using for the next however long.
Yeah, and the sad thing is my career was markets and standing for long periods of time, and I've not been able to trade since 2019, and I'm not in a financial position to finance a production kitchen to hire staff. So my business is on pause, my life is on pause.
Okay.
And there's a lot going on.
And the 15, was it you said, surgeries that you had here, did they ever provide you any relief, Dearn?
They did. Now, I have symptoms from a very young age, and as we know, endometriosis is a full body condition. It wouldn't have been known that when I was, like, I'm 46 now, so when I was an infant even, I had a lot of gastro problems. It was 1999 in Australia at the age of 20 that I had my first women's health diagnosis because I was rushed into hospital out there. So we're dealing with a lot of different doctors not knowing that I had endometriosis until 2005. So I was 26, I got stage 4 diagnosis at that stage. And then I had a few treatments until around 2009, and then I would go back into hospital saying, you know, there's other things not resolved, and I was just sent from pillar to post for so long.
All right, well, I suppose it's probably a little bit of a redundant exercise wondering now if there was a different course of action that would have had a better outcome for you. But I do want to stay with this until the end of the programme. I want to get yours, I want to get other people's reaction to the launch of that National Endometriosis Framework on Saturday. But before I do, please put up with me while we take one break and we come back to you, Dearn, OK?
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
Emma, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I want to jump straight in on your reaction to the National Framework launch and what's in it. So I'm, please forgive me if I'm not giving you a huge amount of space to talk about your condition, but I want to see what it is that you feel about this framework and whether it's an answer to the 300,000 people living with this condition in Ireland.
Initially, I was furious. Do you know, having seen that they had said that paracetamol was a painkiller, do you know, that would give us relief. I mean, like, I know that may be the case for some, but it is not the case for everyone.
But what should they have done in that case, then, Emma? Because, you know, they also say that NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, are, for some people, a suitable kind of pain relief. Should they not have put that information in there, or should they have made it clear in a small number of cases this is going to work?
Yes, absolutely. They should have been more clear about it. For a lot of women with complex endometriosis, they're looking at, more serious pain medication, anti-inflammatories, etc.
Okay. So did it just feel a little bit like, here, take two Disprin and shut up about your pain, missus?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, paracetamol is something that you take for a headache. I mean, like, this is a chronic inflammatory disease. Paracetamol doesn't work for the majority of women.
So you're not disputing that it will work for some, but it just felt a little bit insensitive to you?
Yeah, absolutely, of course. I mean, like, and to see two of the major surgeons that women travel to from Ireland, myself included, not on the list of surgeons was gut-wrenching, to be honest.
Okay. And have you any idea why they're not there?
I'd be thinking that it's because they're private. They're not public hospitals. They're both private centres with endometriosis specialists.
I don't know if that is or that isn't the case, but I suppose they do have to look at these things on a value for money basis as well, and maybe the alternatives that they've come up with are going to be just as effective. But for you, was the procedure that you underwent completely effective?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a different person since my surgery. Now, I do still have issues because I have multiple conditions with no cure, so it's about management for a lot of it. Now, I do have to travel back for surgery again on the nerves on the right side of my pelvis, because you can only have one side done at a time because the recovery is over 12 months. So I do have to travel back again at some stage to have more surgery.
Is there anything else in the National Framework that you saw that surprised you or you thought was a good idea?
I suppose there was good things there. Do you know, I mean, like, It does have promise, but it does need a lot of work. It needs a lot of tweaking. And what they need to do is they need to speak to endometriosis patients. They need to get their views. I mean, like, I definitely think that going down the route of, you know, providing patients with endometriosis with a GP visit card or a medical card, because we spend so often in our local GPs and in and out of A&E, that something like that should be considered, you know. I mean, like, you know, it should be put on the list of illnesses for people to claim disability, because there is a lot of women that are unable to work permanently, maybe somewhere.
You can only do that when you have a diagnosis. Do you think that this framework will do anything to speed up that process for people?
Yes and no, I suppose. If women can be seen abroad in clinics that are where they do have specialists, then yeah. But if we're looking at the same scenario as here in Ireland, where it's impossible to get a diagnosis, then it's not going to be very effective.
That's going to be absolutely
the choke point there. That was my initial response. Was that,
okay, now that was the point that was made earlier on by a couple of people as well. Dhiren, what did you see in the framework launched on Saturday that leapt out at you?
That they didn't have enough of the patient advocacy advocates, campaigners that have been campaigning for decades. And I'm not talking about myself, I'm talking about there's advocates in the community who have evidence
based research that weren't even involved in this conversation for the last 4 years. And a framework is only as strong as the resources behind it. So it's
okay, but
really
they did do a big listening exercise, didn't they? So are you just saying that they didn't listen to the voices with the most experience, the most knowledge?
There was no patience brought into the designing of the framework, and they have even said that. They have
really?
Now...
Sorry?
They have recruited...
Are you sure? Can that really be the case?
Well, they'd have to answer that themselves, but as far as I'm aware, a task force invitation was being chosen at random. And we received, not all of us, I received an email on a Thursday evening and the deadline was 3 p.m. on a Monday and they were choosing a task force at random.
Okay, so people might have been invited, but maybe they just weren't in a position to actually contribute and get involved. But are you telling me that this force was composed entirely then of experts and nobody with the condition?
That's as far as I have been told, and that, you know, I welcome a statement on that from the Department of Health to confirm whether that is right or wrong.
All right, well, unfortunately, we've only got 2 minutes before the end of the programme to confirm if that was the case. Is there anything in there that you think will work?
They need to include extrapelvic endometriosis. It has to be an all-body multidisciplinary team, and that's doesn't mean like your psychologist and your physiotherapist. I'm talking about neurologists, thoracic and bowel specialists. Like I need about 5 different multidisciplinaries now. Where am I going to get that? Do I have to fly the whole way to Romania again? That's an 8-hour journey for me because I live in Kerry. And I haven't been working, so I don't earn a wage. So how am I going to come up with the travel?
Okay.
No, I know they're saying that they're going to cover travel, but are they going to cover all the accommodation? Are they going to cover travel for the companion you need to bring with you? So they're the questions that we would like to have publicly answered.
So this a national maternity setting wouldn't be sufficient. This is something has to be in one of our major acute hospitals where there would be any number of other different disciplines on call.
Absolutely. And something I want to also cover is I had to have a hysterectomy at 37 years of age. I lost my fertility around the age of 26. And every time I have to go into A&E, I'm brought into a gynecology ward. Like my last trip now, I was sent from ambulance from
I can't imagine how that much that must hurt. All right. Look, unfortunately, I'm going to have to stop this particular phase of the conversation, but this is not something that's going away and a conversation that Liveline is going to have again and again. But Darren, thank you very much, and Emma, and everybody else who called. Today's programme was produced by Ailish O'Shea. James Feeney was on sound. Laura Lee Davis is the broadcast coordinator. Brendan Courtney is up next.